From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another 2014 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow here in Little Rock. I'm Phil Marriage, your host. I'm really glad you guys can be with us this afternoon on what I think is going to be one of the more important program topics we've done in our 14 years on the air. Before I get into that, though, I do want to remind you, if you'd like to listen to the longer version of all of our programs, this one included, you can catch it at several sites. It's podcast. You can find that at our site at kuar.org. You can go to yttshow.org. You can find it there. Our topic today is war widows, and I want to briefly introduce my guests to you, and then as we get into it, they'll expand a little bit more about who they are and what they've gone through. Speaking from the younger generation and joining us from San Diego, California, is Erin Drucker. She's an instructor and an event facilitator with the American Widow Project. And by the way, let me say, I'll have the links to all of these guest information on our website, too. But the American Widow Project is a major source I found for people who would like to find a lot of information about widowhood. Her husband, Blake Stevens, was killed in Iraq in 2007 by a roadside bomb. And Erin Drucker, I'm so glad to have you with us here today.
Thank you. Me too.
And then speaking from the middle generation perspective, joining us from Santa Rosa, California, is author Pauline Laurent. She's the author of Grief Denied, A Vietnam Widow's Story, Recovery from Trauma. Her husband, Howard, was killed on May 10th in 1968. Pauline, glad to have you with us here too.
Thank you so much, Phil, for inviting me.
And then joining us from the older generation perspective from Vernon, Texas, is Peggy S. Harris. Peggy Harris and First Lieutenant Billy D. Harris were married for just 6 weeks before Billy deployed in World War II. He was flying a mission over Nazi-occupied France when his plane was shot down and crashed into the woods near a small town in Normandy, and he never returned. And Peggy went years and years and years before finding out just recently about how he ended up. Peggy Harris, glad to have you with us here, too.
Thank you.
But I was thinking about the fact that wars really are like the tree rings of human history. And these three wars, World War II, Vietnam, and the Iraq War, are three of those rings in our history. And one of the aspects about all the wars that we've ever had that we don't talk about hardly at all is the widows from those wars. And we want to take time today to talk with these widows. I'm so thankful to have a widow from the World War II, the Vietnam, and the Iraq War, to have our audience have the chance to listen to this aspect of war. Let me begin with you, Peggy Harris. Tell us just a little bit briefly about the history of your situation.
Oh, goodness. I have pages. Well, we had several young men, my classmates, were killed early on, very early on, and they were just out of high school. One of my classmates had an older brother. He was killed in flying the hump over India and China, and only a few months later, his brother, my classmate, was killed in a plane in Europe. So that family lost both sons within a few months. So our town knew loss early on. I would just say that they were very stoic about it. They accepted that in war this was happening, and it would happen to us in our area, and they were accepting of that, that it was a necessary thing that would be coming to us.
How did that express itself by your neighbors? Or did I thought about this from the standpoint of what I have seen so many times in Hollywood where they show the car pulling up in the driveway. And I don't know if that's really...
nothing at all. Like
that's what I wanted to ask you. What really happened during that time, and how did you find out?
Well, first, of course, I found out that he was missing in action. I had worked at Alpha's, his hometown, at the air base, as the only woman mechanic. I was an electrical instrument mechanic. I had an occasion to take instruments out of a plane that had crashed, and it had blood on the dials, and I was pretty shaken by it, and I decided to take a leave of 2 or 3 weeks. Friends of mine were in University of Colorado at Boulder and had wanted me to come there. So I took leave and went up there. And the person who came with the telegram to the doorway there was just a young boy. And when I went all to pieces and began to recover a little, I looked again at the telegram, and the telegram said July 7. I knew that was wrong because I had letters dated later than that in my possession. My friends took me to the telegraph office, and I showed them their telegram, and I showed them my letters. And they were puzzled, said they'd get on it and see what was what. And a couple of days later, they came with a telegram saying it was the 17th of July, not the 7th.
You had to suffer through that twice then?
Yes.
I can't imagine what that must have been like. Tell me about that particular time. What did a widow do? Were you by yourself in this moment, or did people come?
I had a very, very close friend, high school chum, and her parents were there. Her father was getting his master's degree that summer, so they were there for me.
But now, were you given notice that he was actually killed or that he was just missing?
No, we didn't know that. We didn't. Matter of fact, I was back home, and it was about 6 weeks, maybe 2 months later, I had received in the mail from SHAEF, Supreme Headquarters, European Allied Forces, release in our newspapers here and in Altus, telling that he was back in the States, giving all of his information about his awards and medals and where he'd served and his parents' names and my name and all of that, and that he was back in the States.
Alive?
Yes.
Well, how did that mix-up ever get straightened out?
It really never did, but I went to the American Red Cross in our town and begged them to look into it for me. And they refused. They said,
"No way."
Yeah, they said that if it came from SHAEF, it was correct, and if it would only be a costly expense for them to begin the search, and then have it turn out that he was in a hospital somewhere or being processed, so they would do nothing. Yes. So if you,
that is so crazy that they did nothing for you, and you had,
yeah,
you had this. Oh my goodness.
So a few weeks later, I figured out that maybe I should contact our congressman. Of course, there was no email. There was no telephone, that sort of thing. So I wrote to him and sent him. Of course, I couldn't copy. There wasn't a copy machine. I sent him the release. He had other things, of course, to be doing in Washington in a wartime, and as well as nationally. But in time, he wrote to me and said that he had sent the release to Switzerland, to the Swiss International Red Cross. And it was quite some time after that that one Sunday, I was in a teacher in a primary class in Sunday school, and Mr. Martin came and told me that I needed to go home immediately, and he would take me. My house was probably a mile and a half, 2 miles away. And when I got there, there were cars, and my husband's parents' car was there. And when I saw that, I was pretty sure what was going on. And when I went into the house, his parents told me they had been notified that he had been killed in action. They were in terrible grief, but also somewhat in denial, because we had nothing but a very bare faith. They had nothing but a very bare statement. And so there was a time of going through trying to sort that out.
So from the first time you thought that he was missing to that day when you were when you went home from the Sunday school class, how much time had passed there?
Well, several months. I'm not sure right now.
I'm kind of curious, Peggy. Was it a grieving time, an anticipatory time, or how did you handle that several-month period of time?
I don't know. I really don't.
Did you cling on to hope? Like, I feel like I would have clinged on to the hope that he was still alive and that they were messing
with
that.
That was what his parents and I both did. And the one thing we learned from the International American Red Cross, or at least from news of them, was that when they had submitted this information that he was missing in action, the paper that they sent was returned to them, and it was simply stamped, killed in action. And there was no further information whatsoever. And we learned later that there was, at the end of the war, we learned that some pilots that had been listed as by the Germans killed in action were actually prisoners of war at the end of the World War. So we really had no definite, we felt we had no definite conclusion.
Well, that's entirely different than what I guess my image is of person who wasn't around during that time. I always thought that you got pretty good information right off the bat, but it sounds like you were in the dark for a long time.
Yes, a long time.
Well, let's move up for just a minute and stay with us here, Peggy. We'll come back to you. I want to move up to Pauline Laurent and your experience. How does that compare with what you heard from Peggy, Pauline?
Well, my experience was I was living with my parents in Southern Illinois. My husband had been in Vietnam a couple months. At that time, the war was heating up in Vietnam, and we were informed that the communists were invading South Vietnam and that we were going to be sending troops over there. So there was a draft, and my husband was drafted into the military. He decided to enlist for an extra year because at the time, he went to see a recruiter, and a recruiter told him that if he enlisted, he wouldn't have to be in combat. He would have an administrative job. So he believed the recruiter, and he enlisted, and we weren't married at the time. He enlisted, and he went through different kinds of training. Eventually, he was in a training specifically to go to Vietnam. It was the NCOC school, which was a school to train sergeants to go to Vietnam because a lot of men were getting killed there, and they needed replacements. So he went to OCS, and after 18 weeks of OCS, he was kicked out for not being... They told him he was not forceful enough to be a military officer, and every time he would get new orders, he would pull out his administration guarantee and say, you know, I enlisted so I could get an office job, and why am I not in the office? And basically what they told him was that that guarantee was worthless because we were now in a war, even though Vietnam was never a declared war. We were in a war, and that guarantee was worthless. So he got orders. You know, when he was in this NCO school, he begged me to marry him. So he came home one weekend. We got married. I went back to Fort Benning with him. He was at Fort Benning for a couple months, more training. Then he went to Fort Jackson, South Carolina for more training, and I was there. And then when he got orders for Vietnam, he thought it would be best for me to go live with my parents. So we drove from Fort Jackson to Southern Illinois. And I actually did get notification. The green army car pulled up in front of my house. By this time, I was 7 months pregnant. We didn't plan to start a family, but some divine being intervened, and I was pregnant. I had actually been told I couldn't get pregnant because I had to have major surgery, and that was just fine with me. I didn't want to be pregnant. He was going to Vietnam. So we got married, and before you know it, I am pregnant. This was a big shock to me. Anyway, he's going to Vietnam. I'm pregnant. I'm living at my parents'. The green army car pulled up in front of my parents' house, and the men were in uniform, and the dog was barking, and I went to the window and looked out. And I knew, because I had had a premonition that my husband had been killed about 5 days earlier. I was reading the St. Louis newspaper. It was Mother's Day weekend. And I was glancing through the paper, and there was an article in there about my husband's unit, his company, his battalion, 9th Infantry Division. And there was an article stating that some people had been killed. And when I read that, I knew my husband was dead. And I got very upset, and my mother came out and said, "What's wrong?" I was sitting outside under a big tree in the backyard, a big sycamore tree, and she said, "What's the matter?" And I just handed her the paper, and I said, "Howard's dead." And she said, "Well, don't be ridiculous. You don't know that." Well, anyway, 5 days later, they pulled up in front of the house, and they came to the door, and they were very formal. They just, it's kind of like they had a script, and they just read this script. "We regret to inform you that your husband, Sergeant Howard E. Query, has been fatally wounded in Vietnam." And I remember thinking, fatally wounded, what does that mean? Let's see, wounded, fatal, you know, my mind started spinning. I got real dizzy, couldn't think straight. I invited him in, and they sat down and informed me of all the things that were going to happen. The body would be returned. There'd be a funeral. There'd be medals and this and that. And I just sat there like a good little girl because I had been trained to be a good little girl. So I just sat there being very gracious like a good little girl, listening to everything that I was told. I didn't scream and rant and rave like I've heard other widows did. I would have been better off if I'd have done that. I was just numb. So they left, gathered up their papers and left. I went into my room, slammed the door, and threw myself on the bed and just sobbed. My unborn fetus started squirming and getting very agitated, and my mother was concerned. She thought I was going to go into premature labor, and she kept telling me, "You got to be strong, you got to be strong, you got to get up, you got to eat, you got to keep going." And I think the fact that I was pregnant did help me want to live, to continue, because I knew I had to, because I had part of him growing inside of me, and I had to go on. And it took 2 weeks for the body to come back, and when the body did come back, we were told, what was the word they used? Non-viewable. His remains were non-viewable. And that was really hard, because what my mind did was I just grasped for a little glimmer of hope that maybe it really wasn't him.
Yeah.
And I hung on to that hope for 25 years that I didn't see him dead, therefore he must not be dead. And that glimmer of hope that I hung on to, that whole 25 years, I was basically in the first stage of grief, which is denial. So I'm a firm believer that when someone dies, it's really important to see them, touch them, see their dead body. Otherwise, you could do what I did, which was live for 25 years in denial.
And Peggy, how many years did you live that way? Wasn't it about 60 or so?
You never stopped.
Let's move up just a little bit here, too, and give Erin Drucker a chance to kind of relate her situation, too. Erin Drucker, go ahead, inform us on how it might have been different for you in these recent years.
I think the technology from the stories of Pauline and Peggy is that I think that with us in this generation, it seems to move a lot faster. There aren't as many questions because they're pretty much all answered for you. I had lived in Fort Benning with Blake, and we were stationed there for about, I want to say, 8 months before they got their orders to go to Iraq. And when he deployed, as the other two have said, I went to go live with his family. When I got to Idaho, he's from Pocatello, Idaho. Blake had joined the military when he was 17. His parents actually had to sign that form saying that you would join while you were still in high school. He was gone for 2 months to the day. He died in May 8th, and so when Pauline told me that, or told us all May 10th, it just made me smile because it was kind of really close to the same time frame, and
Yeah, so with me, I actually was at his sister's house. I spent the night, and we were all going to just go out and have a good day. And so I actually didn't have the same experience as the other two. I had his mom call me, and she was frantically crying, and I thought that his grandfather had passed away. And she couldn't tell me. So I just knew something was wrong, and as soon as his sister grabbed the phone from me, and then she looked at me and started kind of crying and sobbing, I knew, like, no one even had to tell me, because I think at that moment, I don't know if maybe Blake had come to me or something, but, like, I just went completely numb, and I had all these chills, and then I just knew. And like the other Pauline and Peggy, it's you just become numb and you kind of just sit there and you don't really know what to do because there isn't anything that says, you're a widow. This is what's supposed to happen. So I moved home to California and I kind of just try to find my place in life. But with that time frame, you know, when Peggy was saying how long it took for her to just figure out, like, you're getting a telegram, you know, and you wait 2 months, it was like I had everything done within that first month, and I know that might even seem like a long time for some, but it took Blake about, I want to say, 2 weeks to get home. He was the first person in Idaho to have passed, and so it was very public. We were all over the TV and the newspapers. We had people kind of harassing us, not in a bad way, but they just wanted to hear the story so that they could get it out. His family was amazing, and to where they almost shielded me because I didn't want to talk to anyone. I felt like you guys are intrusive, and this isn't what I want you to hear right now because I can't even breathe. I need to focus on just minute by minute and not, you know, I thought that they wouldn't get my story. And I think a lot of widows feel that way as well. Is it's definitely something that you connect with other widows because you don't even have to speak about what the issue is. So I dealt with that for about, I want to say, a month. We had a lot of ceremonies for him, which were really good. When he came home, they didn't not give me an option to have an open casket, but it was pretty much told that you wouldn't even be able to see him. He would be wrapped up, like mummified. So I didn't want to do that. I don't know, I just told the people, I'm like, I need to know that, because like Pauline and Peggy, you want to know that that's who it is. Like, I don't want any doubt in my mind that maybe there's a chance. So the funeral director, he actually unwrapped him a little bit to check and make sure, and he had a lot of tattoos, and so he identified some of his tattoos, and that gave me a little bit more peace that I knew that it was him. Yeah, that was kind of how that first month went.
Well, you know, Aaron, you're talking about a community that was vibrantly involved with you, and I think when I heard Peggy talk about the fact that the community was rather stoic, the word she used there, I'm wondering, Pauline, how did the community handle Vietnam deaths and Vietnam widows?
The community I was living in was a small town in southern Illinois, very Catholic, very, very patriotic, and, you know, my husband was a hero. There was a lot of sympathy and feeling bad for me. I can't say that, you know, my parents were not there for me emotionally. My parents were pretty emotionally distraught themselves. There was really no one that was there for me emotionally. You know, what I conclude now after all these years is that the only emotional connection I had was with my unborn child, because I felt like that was a piece of my husband, and that was such a odd thing anyway that I got pregnant. So, you know, I was pregnant. I knew I was going to have part of Howard with me. And my emotional connection was with this unborn child. And, you know, that child was born 2 months after he died. And the emotional connection with her has been a major issue in my life. Problematic because I have learned to rely on her too much emotionally. And now she's 45 years old, and she kind of, like, you know, wants mom to get off her back, understandably so. So I have learned 45 years later, there's still letting go to do. You know, I can't be so involved in this daughter's life. I must let her go and let her have her own life and not emotionally depend upon her.
Mm-hmm. Peggy, let me come back to you. You've had these decades to go through this, and if I understand right, you never remarried. Is that correct?
Correct. I wanted to tell you this, that the people at Levant, where he veered the plane so that it would not crash in the village, he was buried there, and because his jacket said Billy D. apostrophe, just D, no period, Billy D. Harris, they thought he was Canadian, and they kept the Canadian flag there for 60 years. And what I learned in November of 2005 was that this French woman had sent for records about him at their 60th celebration. Someone came, an official came, and when they saw it said ALTUSOKLA, they said, that's not in Canada, that's in the United States. The remains were warehoused later at Cherbourg, France, and then later interred in the American Normandy Cemetery.
Ladies, I can only thank you very deeply for you guys talking with me here today. It's been a very difficult topic to approach, and I hope we've done it justice here. I do want to thank all three of you for being with me. And again, folks, as you've listened to the program, if you'd like to listen to the longer version, go to our website at KUAR.org and click on Programs. You'll be able to find the longer version there. It's the podcast version. I do want to thank my guest, speaking from that younger generation, and she was joining us here today from San Diego, has been Erin Drucker. She lost her husband in 2007 in Iraq in a roadside bomb. Erin, thanks so much for sharing with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed talking to everyone and hearing their stories.
And speaking from that middle generation perspective from that Vietnam era has been Pauline Laurent. She's the author of the book Grief Denied, A Vietnam Widow's Story, Recovery from Trauma. Her husband, Howard, was killed back in 1968 in Vietnam. And I'm sure, Pauline, that that book will get another bump here from those who listen to the program here. Pauline, thanks so much for being with us here.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you for the topic and the opportunity to speak with other widows. And I just wanted to add, you know, you mentioned the courage of the widow. Well, you know, our men went to war. Our husbands went to war. They had a lot of courage to go into battle.
Yes.
Right.
Definitely.
Right. Our older generation guest, and Peggy, I just have to ask you this. How old are you?
June 24th of this year, I will be 90.
Ooh.
And I guess you're retired from the library system, is that right?
Yes, but that is where I use the access the computer, and every once in a while they ask me if I'd like to come back and work there.
Peggy Harris has been our older generation guest. Her husband, Billy D. Harris, was shot down in Nazi-occupied France during World War II. Peggy, I'm so honored that you were with us here today.
Well, I appreciate your linking me up with these two wonderful women. They are remarkable.
Yes, they are. And again, I will post the information for both Pauline's book and also the American Widow Project on our site. And I'm also going to put a link on there to Peggy's story, too, because there's a lot of information on the web there about her story that we couldn't really get here and get to today. But I do want to thank you all for joining us today. Again, if you'd like to listen to that longer version, it's on the web. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.